You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Wendy Friedman, today one of the world's most influential astronomers, was just 7 years old the night her father showed her the sky in the evening over northern Ontario and told her that what she was looking at, quote, might not be there anymore. He explained to her about the finite speed of light, that what she was seeing was, quote, as it was when the light left it. That is one of the moments, she said, moments of awe that hooked her on astronomy. She is now University Professor of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. For 30 years, she was associated with the Carnegie Institute of Washington in Pasadena. And how many of you know about the Carnegie Observatory in Pasadena? Great. Well, find out more about it because it's amazing and it's right here. She received a Carnegie Fellowship at the observatories in 1984, joined the faculty in 1987, and became director in 2003. Today, Dr. Friedman focuses on measuring both the current and past expansion rates of the universe, I can't pretend to tell you what that is, and on characterizing the nature of dark energy, the mysterious force that causes the universe to accelerate its expansion. She serves as chair of the board of directors of the Giant Magellan Telescope Project since its inception in 2003, and she co-leads the Carnegie Supernova Project, which uses the 100-inch and Magellan telescopes at Las Campanas in Chile to better understand dark energy. For his work, Sean Carroll, a theoretical physicist, does not use giant lenses. From what I understand, his main tools, besides his brain, are paper and pencil. He studies the structure and evolution of the universe, does research on theoretical aspects of cosmology, and tries to answer a simple question, what is time? He's the author of popular level books, you laugh, but it's a big question, From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time, and The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World, and we have that book in paperback for sale tonight. These two extraordinary scientists are both known for their active engagement with a broader public, for their knack, if you will, for explaining complex scientific phenomena in digestible form. And with that in mind, we all have the great good fortune tonight to listen in on their conversation. Please welcome Wendy Friedman and Sean Carroll. Thank you.
So thank you, Louise. I'm Sean Carroll. It's great to be back here. The first time that I was up here on the stage was a couple of years ago, and I mentioned as part of the conversation that what first got me interested in science was when I hung out at my local public library growing up. So now they love me, and they keep inviting me back. So it's very good to be back here. And if all goes well tonight, Wendy will be doing most of the talking. But I wanted to set the stage just a little bit before we begin. So as you know, Los Angeles is an industry town, and the industry is not cosmology. But if you are a working scientist here in the LA area, you will occasionally speak with people in the movie business. And so one day I was talking to a screenwriter, an actually accomplished screenwriter, and he was excitedly explaining to me his new idea. And he said, there's a character, he's kind of like Albert Einstein, and in his basement, he's built a time machine. And I felt a little bit bad, but I had to explain. I said, you know, probably Albert Einstein himself could not build a toaster in his basement because there are what we call theoretical physicists who have equations and pieces of paper and they think and, you know, they sit at Starbucks or whatever. That's where they do their work. And then there are experimental and observational scientists who build things and look at things and collect the data and actually find out how the world really is.
They separate. We don't let them near the telescope.
Yes, no. It's been a long time since I've touched a telescope. So, and here we have both halves. And of course, these days, everyone's seen the Big Bang Theory, so they know that there are the Sheldons and the Leonards. I'm the Sheldon. Wendy is the Leonard, the experimental observational scientist. So I'm a theoretical physicist. Wendy's a very accomplished observational astronomer looking at the world and figuring out how it is. And so with that dichotomy in mind, you get the best of the both worlds. And I thought, and especially auspicious is the fact that we are celebrating this year the centennial of Einstein's greatest accomplishment, the general theory of relativity. It was in 1915 that Albert Einstein published the final form of his grand theory of space and time, general relativity. And it was truly, you know, it was a world-changing event in how we think about the universe. Before that day, we thought that space and time were just there. They were fixed. They were the background. They were the stage on which the actors were playing. And Einstein comes along and says that actually there's a role to be played by the stage, that space-time itself is dynamical. It can change. It can do things. And people started thinking about this furiously, and there were many great ideas. And one of the ideas was, again, Einstein himself realized that if you have a universe full of stuff, full of stars and matter and so forth, it can't just sit there. It can't just be a static universe doing the same thing because the space and the time beneath it respond to the stuff in the universe. It must change. If the universe is smooth, it must either be growing or shrinking. He hated this. Why did he hate this? Well, there's the popular story that he was distorted by his philosophical preconceptions and he needed to be rudely awakened by empirical reality. The truth is, he was listening to his astronomer friends, and the astronomer friends told him that the universe was static, and they turned out to be wrong. So one of the great stories in science over the last 100 years is figuring out how this implication of Einstein's theories, that the universe had to be dynamical, that it needed to be expanding or contracting or somehow changing in some way, turned out to be right. And there was no theoretical physicist at the time who had the bravery to say that that was going to be right. It was in the hands of the experimentalists, the observers, to actually look at the universe and tell us what was happening. With that in mind, so what was going on? How do we actually first take these steps to find out what was happening?
So it's nice to be giving this talk in LA because a lot of that happened right here in the LA area in Pasadena. And there was an astronomer by the name of George Ellery Hale, which we can, if you could show the first slide. And George Ellery Hale was at the then called the Mount Wilson Observatories in Pasadena, California. And he came out to Pasadena, brought his family around 1902. Pasadena was a place that had dirt roads and really very little for itself.
Not like today.
Not like today, that's right. A world center, which it is in many respects. It's a world center in terms of learning, and Caltech and JPL and the Huntington Gardens. And it is a phenomenal place, actually, intellectual center now, Pasadena. And it is due to George Ellery Hale. And Hale had gone to MIT. He wanted very much for there to be something in Pasadena like that. And he was interested in building large telescopes. And what attracted to him to Pasadena were the San Gabriel Mountains. And he's shown here, he did the site surveying himself and recognized that Pasadena was one of the best sites in the world for astronomical telescopes. Why? At the time it was dark. The lights in Los Angeles were not blocking the view. And it also turned out that the prevailing winds from the ocean would hit the San Gabriels. There was nothing in the way, and so it didn't cause a lot of turbulence. And the atmosphere is very steady over Mount Wilson. And Hale set about building what would become, at the time, the world's largest astronomical telescopes. And he convinced Andrew Carnegie to help build a series of telescopes. And Carnegie's name is interesting, too. You raised the issue of libraries, but Carnegie donated a phenomenal amount of money for libraries across the U.S. and in Scotland, and it turns out in Toronto, where I grew up, I worked in a library. Well, I spent all my time in a library as a kid. I read every book on astronomy on the shelves, and I didn't know that the library where I worked and grew up as a kid was a Carnegie Library till about a year ago when a friend of mine happened to tell me that, which is very interesting. So libraries have their a really inspiring role, and clearly for both of us, a big one. So Hale built a 60-inch telescope. He first built solar telescopes, then he built a 60-inch, then a 100-inch telescope, and he ultimately was responsible for building the 200-inch telescope at Palomar, Mount Palomar.
Maybe you can tell us what the inches are measuring.
Yeah, the inches, measure the diameter of the primary mirror. And so Galileo, of course, was the first person to turn a telescope to the sky in 1609, and that was a 2-inch telescope. And it was a phenomenal breakthrough because he was able for the first time to see that Jupiter had moons that circled it. That wasn't supposed to happen. There was nothing except for our own planets that were circling the sun. Circling the Earth. They weren't circling the sun. Everything was going around the Earth. And he was able to show that Venus, the planet next to Mercury before Earth, had phases very much like we see the phases of the moon that showed that Venus was going around the sun. So it contributed to the idea of a sun-centered or heliocentric universe. He resolved the Milky Way, what we see as this band of light, which of course we don't see from LA anymore.
See about you may have six, heard of the Milky
six
Way.
Six stars yes. from LA. But phenomenal discoveries. And essentially every time that we have built new telescopes, we have made discoveries without exception, which is why astronomers remain really excited about building new telescopes. And that is because the information that we get about the universe comes from studying light from distant objects. And the bigger the telescope, or the bigger the diameter of the primary mirror, the more light we can collect, and the greater the resolution or the clarity of the objects that we can see. And so George Elliott Hale was instrumental in setting the course of astronomy and cosmology and these discoveries that when Hale eventually built these telescopes and the young astronomer by the name of Edwin Hubble came to Pasadena. And so here's Hubble and Hubble, double Hubble. Why is that letting me advance? That's interesting. I'm not able to advance my slides.
Try going right instead of up. Nope. Space.
Space.
Nope, it's broken. Technology, what can you do? So
eventually I'll show you Hubble, but...
Yeah, what if you hit escape and came back? But it is very funny. It's almost a cliche in science, one way or the other, that the people ask, well, why was this particular discovery made at this particular time? Why didn't Aristotle or Archimedes figure out that there were moons going around Jupiter? And so the cliche is that you really need to develop the technology to make the new discoveries, and then the theorists sort of jump on board quickly thereafter. We all have heard of Hubble. He was the guy who made these discoveries.
This Hubble, the person.
This Hubble, there he is.
Big
that's his name,
and then
yes.
And Hubble telescope.
And fewer of us have heard of Hale, who built the telescopes. But building the telescopes is just as important as looking through them.
Yeah, and Hale recognized that, and convinced Andrew Carnegie that this was an important thing to do. And of course, amazing discoveries followed. Hard to predict at the time. And what Hubble did was to set out, so Hubble, many of you may know of Edwin Hubble, but you probably don't know much about the man. And so he was in Pasadena. He came here in 1919, which was the year that the 100-inch telescope was commissioned at Mount Wilson, then the largest telescope in the world. And he was interested in studying a class of objects that were at the time called nebulae. So these fuzzy kind of objects shown at the bottom here. And they were a class of objects that had been known since the 1700s, when people started looking at the sky, cataloging, started taking photographic plates of objects eventually in the 1800s, 1900s. And there was an astronomer, a French astronomer by the name of Messier, who was a comet hunter. And Messier made a catalog of objects that were uninteresting. Because they weren't comets.
They got in the way of finding the comets.
They were,
yes.
It was one person's noise is another person's gold. And,
so true.
And this was Messier's noise. And these objects, there grew eventually to be a debate about what the nature of the nebulae were. were they objects that were within our own Milky Way galaxy? And maybe you can see the spiral form of this particular nebula, which is the Andromeda Nebula. And maybe this was a region where gas and dust were congregating and eventually collapsing because of gravity to form new stars in our Milky Way galaxy, which we thought was the universe at that time. And then there was another group who thought, no, these were things that could be much farther away, and they were galaxies or nebulae in their own right. And it was Edwin Hubble who solved this problem, and I have to get out every time.
Really? That's too bad.
Apparently. And what Hubble was able to show was that these were objects that were so distant that, in fact, they were galaxies in their own right, very similar to our own Milky Way galaxy. And what we now recognize is that these objects have about 100 billion stars in them, like our own Milky
Way. So some of the nebulae were that, right?
Some of the nebulae
really were.
That's right.
Clouds of gas in our Milky Way galaxy forming
Correct.
Stars.
Yeah. And Hubble was studying a particular kind of nebula, and he discovered a particular kind of star in that nebula that allowed him to measure the distances, and we can get into that in a moment. But what we've learned from Edwin Hubble's observations taken at the Mount Wilson 100-inch telescope in Pasadena is that not only do these nebulae have about 100 billion stars within them, but there are about 100 billion galaxies in the observable part of our universe, which is a rather astonishing.
And this feeds into a very good cosmology joke I learned from your colleague, John Carlstrom, because there's 100 billion, roughly speaking, stars in a galaxy. There's roughly 100 billion stars, 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe. And the universe is roughly 100 billion years old if you measure it in dog years. In human years, it's about 14 billion years old. So there's some comment on who is important here measuring the universe. It's also about 100 billion neurons in the human brain. And if you count all the grains of sand on all the beaches of Earth, it's equal to the number of stars in the observable universe.
See, this is what theorists spend their time
on. What else do we have to do, really? So the universe is very big. I mean, to go back to the Milky Way for a second, I mean, the Milky Way is what gets me when it comes to the size of the universe. You know, when you're out there, if you've ever been out there on a dark night or whatever, the stars are fine. I mean, the other galaxies you can't really see with your eyeballs, but you see the Milky Way stretching.
Not in LA.
The horizon. Not in LA, but I get dizzy when I'm out there like looking at the Milky Way because I know it's a big disk and we're on the edge of it and it's spinning and I worry that something is going to fall off or something. I don't know what I worry
You're
about.
You're a flat earth kind
but,
of person.
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, and then, so Hubble was the first person in the world to figure out that these splotches were the size of the Milky Way galaxy. They were galaxies all by themselves. What must have gone through his head, do you think?
No, I think he was pretty blown away by that. And so blown away, I think, that he didn't even believe the implications of his next discovery, which is maybe even more monumental.
But let's not
so he might have been famous just for this one.
Yeah, this was pretty good. I mean, the universe is big. That's what he discovered, right? We always knew it was big, but Edwin Hubble made the universe a lot bigger. So how did he know? How did he take a picture of that galaxy and go, oh, yes, 100 billion stars?
Yeah. So Hubble started using the Mount Wilson telescope to take a series of photographic plates. And the photographic plates were the detector of choice at the time he was observing in 1919. So these were glass plates, photographic plates, and he would expose and take an image of one of these galaxies every night over a period of months and sometimes years. And he was looking at... Do I have... No, I have to come in and out.
And in the meantime, we're going to be impressed by the phrase glass plates. I mean, literally, I've held these in my hands. Like, they were plates of glass that were the equivalent of the photographic film, right? I mean, you could just do much better with a plate of glass than with a bit of film.
Now we use digital detectors, of course, like what are in our handheld cameras. And you didn't have the pleasure, what I did, of as a graduate student, taking these glass plates and actually developing the plates in Fixer and cutting your hands on the edge of the glass and putting them in chemicals that then stung like crazy. But if you think of it, the photographic plate allowed astronomers for the first time to integrate the signal, collect the photons of light that are coming from distant objects. And other, you know, unlike the human eye, where you could record things, see things, you could build up a signal over time and therefore see much fainter objects than it was possible to do, and over a much wider area with these large photographic plates. And so what Hubble noticed was that within the nebulae, there were individual pinpoints of light, turned out to be stars. And if he observed over a period of time, most of the stars, as Sean says, they're not very interesting. They're kind of dull. If you come back over time, they don't change over a human lifetime. They're the same brightness every time we come and we go and look at them. But some of them change in brightness over time. Let's see if it will let
it
me
It could
show
be that
this.
The stars are interesting and we're dull. I don't want to prejudice
It could stars. Well be. And there are some stars, oh, it won't even show the blinking, that's interesting. Okay, this machine doesn't like us tonight. If you could see my screen, there are some little blinking pinpoints of light. And they turned out to be a very interesting kind of object. They're called a Cepheid variable, and they are stars that aren't boring like most stars. They actually change their brightness over time. And they do that on timescales. Maybe you can even see this. Can you see them blinking here? Yeah. Anybody?
Yeah. Blinking.
And, you know, would it be that simple that they just, you know, we looked at them and they blinked? They don't. They change over timescales of 2 or maybe 100 days or so. But within these galaxies, there are these stars that, it turns out, their outer atmospheres are moving in and out. They're actually pulsating. They're changing their size. And as they do that, their radius changes. They change in brightness. And the bigger the star is, the brighter it is. And the smaller it is, the fainter it is. And they do that over a time scale of days to months. And Hubble recognized that the behavior of these stars resembled a star that had been known since the 1700s, observed in our own Milky Way galaxy. And they have a unique characteristic that allows you to measure their distance. So that comes back to how did Hubble learn what he did? And we can go into those details, and I don't know whether you want
to. No,
I
think we should, because it's one of those things we almost take for granted, right? Like, you know, astronomers like you measure the distance to things in the sky, but put yourself in the position of standing out there on a dark night and you look at the sky, how in the world do you know how far away anything is, right? And so what would be nice if you knew how bright something was, if you were standing next to it, and you also know how bright it appears far away, then you can figure out how far away it is. But it's almost the case that we don't know how bright anything is in the sky. You know, some stars are really bright, some stars are really dim intrinsically. So how did we figure out the absolute brightness of these wonderful variable stars?
Yeah. So here you are, you're looking at the sky, and these stars, you know, there is a star bright because it's nearby, or is it faint because it's far away? We don't know. And that goes back to some work that was done by an astronomer by the name of Henrietta Leavitt, who was working at the Harvard College Observatory at the turn of the last century. And in 1908, she discovered that these Cepheid variables, the brighter ones took longer to vary than the fainter ones. And the very well-established correlation we now call the Leavitt law, which says that the brighter stars take longer to pulsate, and the fainter ones do this more rapidly. So that gives us a yardstick, then, that we can compare. If we could find these Cepheid variables in other systems and compare their brightness, and if we had some means of measuring the distances to some Cepheids, then we could measure the relative distances and calibrate the absolute distances to any object we could measure them in. And so how do we calibrate the absolute distances? That's the tough part. And it turns out you can do that using geometry, simple Euclid's geometry that we learn in high school. It's really that conceptually simple. So if you can observe a Cepheid, you take your telescope and you look at a star, and suppose we do this in, what month is it? February.
February, yes.
February. So here we are in the Earth's orbit, right? The Earth is going around the sun once a year. And here we are in February. We're looking at this Cepheid variable. Then we wait for the Earth to go around the sun, say 6 months later, and we're observing in August. And we are observing that same Cepheid. And we've now mapped out a triangle. This part of the triangle, of course, is here's the radius of the Earth-Sun orbit. Here's twice the radius. And we have a triangle that is just by Euclid's geometry, we can then establish the distance to that Cepheid variable. So it's an extraordinarily powerful technique. You think back to what Sean just said, you know, we're looking at the sky, we have no information other than the light that is coming to us from these objects. How do we measure distances? That's how we measure distances.
And it is, I mean, we could dwell on this for, but we're running out of time, sadly. You know, we need to get this good stuff in our future. Hubble found out that the universe is big, that these little fuzzy spots in the sky are whole other galaxies. He didn't stop there.
No, he didn't. And what Hubble was able to recognize was these nebulae that he was measuring the Cepheids in, and then he measured bright stars in other galaxies. Their velocities, the speeds at which these objects were moving, had been measured previously, already published, but he was able to show that the farther away a galaxy was, based on the distances he had measured, the faster it was moving away from us. And in fact, there are some galaxies that are moving toward us, appear to be moving toward us, but it's a small fraction of all the galaxies that we can make these measurements for. And what he realized is, okay, the farther away a galaxy is, the faster it's moving away. And that, together now with Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, developed in 1915, says the universe is expanding. There must have been a time in the past when galaxies would have been closer together, expanding in the intervening time. All matter would have been closer together, and it led to a picture of an early universe, hot, dense, fiery Big Bang origin for the universe, that the universe was actually evolving. It wasn't static with time, it had a beginning. Now, of course, that wasn't the only option then, and there was no evidence other than the expansion at that time. We can get to the other evidence later, but it was a revolutionary discovery. The universe is expanding, it's changing with time, and it had a beginning. It's been expanding from a particular
time. I mean, just to put it in perspective, since this is 2015 and 100 years ago was the origin of general relativity, 100 years ago, we knew basically nothing correct about the universe on very large scales. We did not know how big it was. We did not know it was expanding. We thought it was static. In retrospect, it couldn't be static because the universe is changing. Stars are burning their fuel. They don't have an infinite amount of fuel to burn. You know, there's a question. Why weren't people in the 1800s wondering when the beginning of the universe was? But they had this view of space and time from Isaac Newton that says it was infinite. And thank goodness Einstein and Hubble came along and fixed things for us a little bit. But still, we're not done.
We're not done. There's even more we were ignorant about.
Yeah, so now we have a universe. It's big. It's getting bigger. What is it made of?
And we didn't have a clue,
yes.
It turns out.
That's right. But we and here's an example where the theorists did not even try very hard. I mean, it was very much the observers who kept looking at the universe and saying, you know, it looks like there is more stuff in the universe than we see.
A common theme, I think, that will emerge, that it's a natural assumption. We think the universe is made out of the stuff we understand and we know. That's a good starting point. But in the 1930s, again, here in the LA area, it's at Caltech, an astronomer by the name of Fritz Wicki started to look at galaxies like those, in large clusters. Turns out that galaxies like to live near other galaxies. So unlike stars that tend to be very far apart in relation to their sizes, galaxies tend to congregate, and where you find some galaxies, you find lots of others in groups and in large clusters. And he measured, again, their velocities, and it turned out that the galaxies were moving faster than they should have been if based on the mass of the cluster, what you could see. So if there were as little mass as there appeared to be, the galaxies and the velocities he was measuring, they should have been long gone. They wouldn't have been held on by the force of gravity. They would have long ago escaped. And so it was an interesting observation. People made lots of excuses. Maybe there's something wrong with the data. Maybe there's something wrong with the assumptions and his calculations. And it was just a nagging thing that was convenient to ignore because nobody could understand what it was. But by the 1970s, a number of people started to look at this question from very different angles. So, for example, an astronomer by the name of Vera Rubin, who was at the Carnegie Institution, was measuring the velocities of stars within galaxies. So instead of galaxies within clusters, these are individual stars within galaxies themselves. And what she found was that the velocities of the stars were, again, much higher than they could have been based on the amount of mass that was in the galaxy itself. These stars, again, would have exceeded the escape velocity and not be held on by gravity. They should have been long gone. And every object that people were looking at, they could see the same effect. It was inescapable. There are just the velocities of the stars were too large for the amount of mass that was there. And then development of X-ray astronomy, satellites that could go up and measure presence of hot gas, maybe 100 million degree gas within clusters of galaxies. It should have evaporated long ago if there was as little mass as we could see. Einstein made a prediction that through a massive cluster, if you saw starlight coming through from other galaxies, the presence of matter, gravity, would bend or distort light as it was coming through that massive cluster. That was eventually discovered. And all of this evidence led eventually to an inescapable conclusion that there is more matter there than we can see via the stuff we see, the stars, the galaxies, and so on.
Yeah, the way of saying it is over and over again, there's more gravity in the universe than we expect. And Newton and Einstein had told us what gravity is. Gravity responds to the amount of stuff. So gravity is really this wonderful tool for us to use because you can't hide from gravity. You know, you can be the stealthiest ninja in the world. You still have a gravitational field. If the moon were completely invisible, if it were completely transparent and you couldn't see it, we would still know it was there because the moon's gravity leads to the tides here on Earth. And out there in space, in galaxies and clusters of galaxies and so forth, again and again, the observational astronomers are telling us there's more gravity there than we thought, so there's more stuff there than we thought. So what is the stuff?
So astronomers spend a lot of time trying to search for stuff, come up with an answer. Maybe it is rocks, maybe it is gas, cold gas, hot gas, maybe it's black holes, maybe it's stars that have lived their lifetimes and it's only the remnants of those stars, they're too faint to see. And they spent decades searching for this dark matter. It doesn't appear to shine and it's too faint to see. And after decades of searching, the limits, the constraints got so tight that none of those ideas
right.
remained standing. If there were black holes, stuff would fall into the black holes. You'd see X-rays being emitted. If there were planets or rocks, you'd see radiation in the infrared part of the spectrum. It just didn't work. You couldn't explain it by that. And so eventually what people have concluded, and the best idea present, is that this is some sort of particle that is a remnant from the Big Bang. And this particle does not emit electromagnetic radiation. There's no kind of light. It interacts only via gravity. And that's how we see the effects on the luminous things because of gravity.
Yeah, I mean, as a physicist, so we have a list of particles. You know, we've found particles at the particle physics laboratories that we have at the accelerators. We've found quarks and leptons and the Higgs boson, and we can go through the whole list of particles that we know, and none of them suffice to have enough stuff in the universe to make up the most of the stuff. So there's 5 or 6 times as much matter in the universe as there are matter like you and me. So at dinner tonight, to warm ourselves up, to gird our loins for the tough crowd that we faced, there may have been a martini or two that the speakers enjoyed. And a martini, there's gin, and then there's vodka, and then there's a little bit of olive. And so we are the olive in the universe. We're the visible part, but a minority part, and perhaps arguably not the most important part. And when I was a student, when I was a graduate student, there was this funny disagreement between the theorists and observers. So this is late 80s, early 90s, because the theorists, like myself, you know, we work on principles of beauty and elegance. And we had, by pure thought, we knew how much stuff there was in the universe.
And then the observers came along with ugly facts.
And they, yeah, and they, well, as we would say, the observers couldn't find it. Like, we knew how much stuff there was, and the observers went and looked, and even with the dark matter included, they only found about 30% of the stuff that we needed. So what did you do about that? Did you concede defeat?
Well, but so the interesting part of this is that we all turned out to be right.
Yes.
But for reasons that nobody really expected. So the theorists, so part of the elegance, which, and it was elegant, they're not just, you know, crazy, the theorists. it was a beautiful kind of picture. And the argument went something to the effect that if you look at the universe today, it's expanding. And you ask how much matter there is in the universe, what the density of the universe is. There's a certain critical density that is the dividing line between where a universe will expand forever or a universe that would stop because of gravity and contract back upon itself, a critical dividing line. And so, you know, you can think of that easily if you think about us on Earth and, you know, if we had a ball here and we threw it up, that ball would fall down due to gravity. But if you give the ball enough of a kick, enough like a rocket, then you would escape the gravitational field of the Earth, and then that rocket could escape. And so we seem to be living in a universe that was very near to that critical divide. And the probability of, you know, universe that's been expanding for 14 billion years that would be so close to this critical density. And the reason that's unusual is if it had greater than the critical density, then the universe would have collapsed back on itself early in its evolution. If it had less than the critical density, it would have expanded forever. But here we were living right on that divide. And it was as if you took a pencil and you stood it on its end and it was stable. The universe doesn't work
like that.
We'll
make a theorist out of you yet. Keep
I'm not your ordinary observer.
I
have respect for these guys.
You're not ordinary.
So that was a puzzle. And so the theorist said to the observers, okay, guys, you found most of this stuff. Go back and find the rest. And we couldn't. Wasn't
there.
That's true. So we never did. So we were right. There wasn't enough matter. But they were right, because the solution to this conundrum was that the universe turns out to be accelerating. Right. And you may have heard this discovery that the universe is not only expanding, but it's speeding up over time. And there is not only dark matter in the universe, but there's what now astronomers and physicists are referring to as dark energy. There appears to be another kind of substance, something that has a repulsive, almost like a tension, that's pulling the universe apart and causing it to speed up with time. We don't yet know what that is because the theorists haven't figured it out yet.
I know what it is, but yeah.
They have a great name for it, but they have no clue what it is. But in any case, that's what provides the critical density. That's why we see a universe that appears to have a critical density, is that the sum of the matter and the energy density of the universe allow for the fact that why we see this potentially critical.
So the thought was, back in the 1990s, you know, there's stuff in the universe, there's galaxies, there's matter, it moves apart, and you could measure, like maybe if you measured the dynamics of one or two galaxies, you're measuring the amount of matter there, but maybe in between the galaxies you're missing something. But if you measured the total deceleration of the universe, because the galaxies are expanding, but they're pulling on each other, then you're really measuring everything. You're really measuring the gross features of the whole entire universe. And so there were two teams that were racing to find this, and one of them, led in part by a friend of mine, my old graduate school office mate, Brian Schmidt, the name of the team was the High Redshift Supernova Team, measuring the deceleration of the universe. Then they measured the acceleration of the universe. The consolation was they won the Nobel Prize for that.
Yeah.
So they were happy, you know, misremembering the name. Do we have a slide for the acceleration of the universe or for the...
Yes, but apparently I can't...
Yeah, I know, it takes time. Well, we haven't mastered technology yet. But the this is, again, it's up there with the discovery that the universe is expanding, with the discovery of dark matter. The fact that the universe is accelerating is just one of these precious, wonderful, bizarre clues that the universe has given us that we need to cherish, and we don't yet have the full explanation for it, and that's okay. It takes time. This is going to lead to some profound improvement in our understanding of what the universe is truly made of.
So apparently it doesn't want to accelerate for you. It doesn't like...
We live in a static universe here at the LA Library. We're a sort of Newtonian... That's okay. You can imagine. Look at the picture and just imagine it getting bigger.
If you look at my screen, it will accelerate for you.
So what is the inventory that we're left with?
So about 70% of the universe is made of this... Oh, it won't show at all now. That's very interesting. Is made of this dark energy. About 25% of the universe is made of dark matter.
Gin vermouth.
And we, the visible stuff, are made maybe 4%.
The olive, yeah.
The olive.
Yeah.
4% of the total.
The garnish. That's us. We are the...
We are literally the tip of the iceberg. And, yeah. And we don't yet know what the dark matter is, although they're good ideas, good candidates for particles, and people are searching at the Large Hadron Collider and in experiments underground and deep mines, and because these things are so weakly interacting, you have to shield from the signal from other cosmic rays and particles that could add noise to the signal. There are satellites in space that are looking for the effects of dark matter, and there's a Nobel Prize lurking for somebody
waiting.
Who finds the dark matter, but we don't know what it is, and we don't know what's causing the dark energy. We have no idea what that is.
Yeah. So if you watched the Big Bang Theory last week, there was a whole show about
how
was Leonard...
was the telescope.
Leonard and Sheldon. I was watching the Big Bang Theory. I don't know. There's a whole show about how Leonard and Sheldon wrote a paper that was mentioned on a blog. And they mentioned someone else's blog. And I have friends who write for the Big Bang Theory. And it's like, dude, why isn't my blog being mentioned? The reason why is because my blog is called Preposterous Universe. And they thought that that was too funny. They thought that that would not be taken seriously. That they thought that they would have just... been interpreted as making that up. The reason why my blog is called Preposterous Universe is because the universe that people like Wendy have discovered for us is kind of preposterous, right? I mean, 70% dark energy, 25% dark matter, 5% ordinary matter, and these percentages are changing over time. The dark energy is taking over. And so we're in this wonderfully, you know, it's been a lot of progress over the last 100 years, but we're nowhere near done. What are we going to do next? How are we going to answer these questions?
So telescopes have helped us learn about the universe, and of course we're anxious to build that next generation of telescopes because as we build bigger telescopes, well, we can see again farther back into the universe, fainter objects, and we hope to keep making these discoveries. So that's one of the efforts that I've been involved in recently is leading a consortium, an international consortium now, to build the next generation. This is a telescope that's 25 feet in diameter. You may be able to see that there are 7 mirrors, each of one, which is 8.4 meters in diameter. So 25 meters is about 80 feet in diameter. We started with two inches, that's right. Bigger than the diameter of this auditorium. The enclosure for this telescope will stand 60 meters high. It's over 200 feet. It's like a 22-story building. I bet it won't show my movie. I can try, right? I can always try.
Can always try. Many scientists have told themselves that.
Let's see.
This is usually the result. Dark matter.
Look at my screen again. That's right. This is an actual image of dark matter.
The universe. Reality vision.
Sean's version. A theorist vision.
There we are in the corner.
There we are. You may be able to see on the screen, possibly. This is a telescope we're going to put in the Andes Mountains in Chile. It's a site. It's about 8,500 feet elevation. And it's a novel technology. It's kind of fascinating how we make these mirrors. You as a theorist may not care, but it's sort of interesting in its own right. But this is a telescope that will have 10 times the resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope. It will allow us to peer back to the earliest galaxies, the earliest starlight, the earliest black holes that are forming in the universe. Right now with Hubble, and you may have noticed in one of the images that I showed, the faintest objects in that image were formed maybe a billion years or so, half a billion years after the Big Bang. And right now we see them as tiny smudges, but we don't know anything about them. And this telescope, for the first time, will let us, with 10 times resolution of Hubble, learn about their distances, actually see how far away they are, what they're made of, what their chemical composition is, how they've been forming stars, and we actually would be able to see directly the first galaxies and stars to form. And then I think one of the most exciting things this telescope will do is to let us look for and discover, if they're there, planets that are like Earth. And Earth-like in the sense that they might have the potential for life. That with this telescope, we will be able, one, for the first time, to confirm the masses of planets that are faint enough to be like the Earth. And in their atmospheres, we'll be able to deduce, based on their chemical signatures, whether there is, for example, water, ozone, carbon dioxide, the things that are signatures of life on Earth. And this will be the first telescope in the world capable of doing that, which I think is it will be one of those astounding
and discoveries. And you accept donations, is that true? Is it your, that's okay? So I think this is a great place to sort of change gears a little bit and start thinking about questions from the audience. So just again, you know, to put it in perspective again, this is great that you end on Earth-like planets and looking for life, because I remember, not only a cosmologist but a theorist, there's a certain snobbishness that comes along with the job description. And I went to a public talk once by Martin Rees, a very famous cosmologist. And, you know, we study
Sir Lord Rees.
Sir Lord.
I mean, Sir. He was Sir before. Now
he
he's
was
Lord.
Sir. Now yeah,
he's
come Lord. On. Lord. Lord. Lord Baron. Baron. Whatever. England. They have these things. So, but he gave this wonderful talk, and in the middle of the talk, he's giving a cosmology talk. And I know what cosmology is. There's dark matter, there's stars, there's galaxies. In the middle of the talk, he starts talking about life.
Oh, it's working!
I don't know what happened. In the middle of the talk, he starts talking about life on other planets. And I was sitting there going, this is not cosmology. You're not allowed to talk about this. It turns out that people really like talking about life on other planets. And he was ahead of his time, because now we're going to be using the same technology that we use because we're cosmologists and care about the universe to also look for planets doing wonderful things. And so with that, let's open it up. Let's get some questions from the audience. I don't know, is there a microphone or should I just pick on people? There's a microphone back there. Let me pick a question right here. Oh, they'll do that. Okay. We'll just sit back and answer the questions.
Wendy, in terms of the wonder of what man has wrought, would you talk to us a little more about the making of the Giant Magellan Telescope? Because the precision is so exquisite in terms of making the mirrors, for example.
So the mirrors, each one of them is 8.4 meters in diameter. They're made in underneath the football stadium at the University of Arizona. So I think it's one of those things that archaeologists in the future are going to look at our civilization and they're going to say, oh, that's so interesting. They built these places. There are 52,000 seats in this stadium, all to make mirrors.
To celebrate astronomy. Yes. Like that.
This was the brainchild of an astronomer by the name of Roger Angel at the University of Arizona, and he started off in his bathtub and then in his backyard, and he developed a process. So the 200-inch telescope that I talked about earlier, it was at the time the limit of what could be done with a large piece of glass. And in fact, you couldn't build mirrors that were larger than Palomar. It had been tried and worked, because glass is actually heavy and it sags due to gravity. We think of it as solid, but because of the weight of the mirror, as you move it through the sky, it bends and it distorts, and then you don't get a sharp image. And so a number of people in the 1980s started thinking about how do you build the next generation of larger telescopes. And one of the ways that Roger Angel came up with was to make large mirrors, but at first he created them in a rotating oven. So this is an oven that spins as you're melting the glass, and so you obtain the original parabolic shape just because of centrifugal force. So like a bucket of water, you spin it, and the water goes up to the side of the bucket. And so you create the parabolic shape you need to bring the light to a focus, right? A flat piece of glass, the light comes from a distant star and just bounces back straight off the glass. So you need it to be curved so that you can focus the light. So that he achieved the parabolic shape by spinning the mirror, and it's It's an unbelievable process. You see this, this oven, which holds an 8.4-meter mirror, spins at 5 revolutions per minute. Doesn't sound like a lot till you see this thing whipping around. And it heats up to about 1,600 degrees. And there's a point early now they have backup generators, but they didn't at the beginning. So if the power had gone out, you would have lost the whole mirror. So there was a nail-biting time. But the other part of the technology is that there are cores that go into the oven, and it's made of silicate material. They're cores, and for this telescope here, with the mirrors in a circle, every one of the cores has a different height. There are 1,600 of them, and they all have different heights. And then after the mirror is cooled, and that takes about several months. To let it cool slowly enough that you don't form bubbles and cracks, because if you cool it too quickly, you form lots of bubbles and cracks, and then, of course, your mirror's not stable. You take it out carefully, again, with a fixture to lift this thing out. So the oven and the glass weighs about 45 tons. That's the other thing, as it's spinning. The mirrors themselves are about 20 tons, so they move this thing out, put it in a vertical position, and then use high-pressure water to take out the cores, and then you're left with a honeycomb structure, so that the mirror itself has only about a fifth of the weight that it would have if it had been a solid piece of glass. And then when it's in the telescope, you can actually blow air through the back of the telescope so that you can keep the temperature of the glass the same as the temperature of the outside air, and you don't get turbulence forming over the mirror, and of course that's what destroys the stability of the image. And so it's in its own right, just a fascinating process. And
I can just go to Starbucks with a piece of paper. I mean, which would you rather do this? All right, who is next?
When did scientists realize that the universe was larger than the galaxy? And it must have been a rather upsetting realization.
Yeah, and that essentially was Hubble's discovery that there were objects that he could actually show were outside the confines of the galaxy.
There was an ongoing debate before he resolved it.
Yeah, and a famous debate took place at the National Academy of Sciences, and two very well-known astronomers were debating. Was the universe confined to the Milky Way itself, or were there other objects that defined a larger universe? And it was Hubble's observations that clearly resolved the debate.
If you watched Cosmos, you know that Giordano Bruno came up with the idea that there were an infinitely big universe with an infinite number of stars that were very far away, and he got burned at the stake. So we don't do that to astronomers anymore. Hubble, but Hubble did not win the Nobel Prize, to his great chagrin. He sort of campaigned a little bit. He would like to have won it, but.
Next question.
How do you spell the last name of Henrietta Leavitt?
L-E-A-V-I-T-T. And an interesting woman. She was actually deaf, and she died in the early 20s, so she never got to see Hubble's results or understand the implications of her results. And she became a little bit of a footnote. She really doesn't get the credit that she merits, because everything we do in cosmology, the foundation of it, is this period-luminosity relation that Hubble used, that we used, my group, for the Hubble Space Telescope, when we used the to resolve the debate on how fast the universe is expanding. So in 2008, we held a meeting at Harvard in her honor, and since that time, we've made a big effort to stop calling the period-luminosity relation the period-luminosity relation and call it the Leavitt law. There's a Hubble law.
Right. And who was it? I don't know, Jennifer, do you remember? Was it George Johnson who wrote Miss Leavitt's Stars?
Yes.
There's a wonderful biography of her that came out recently. And it's the whole milieu is fascinating. I mean, this is at Harvard in the early 20th century. There was this astronomy effort, and the women served as what were known as computers. You know, there were the men who were professors, and they were thinking.
And they were allowed to get degrees.
Yes, that's
women
right.
Women were not admitted to places like Harvard. And
that's right, but the women were allowed to go in and look at the glass plates, and like maybe they could dabble in a little bit of research, and Henrietta Leavitt dabbled her way up into discovering one of the most important things in all of astronomy.
Second part, is the video accessible online?
The video?
Your videos? Your little...
It will be. This is a new one. So if you go to, she says it here, that's interesting, GMTO, Giant Magellan Telescope Organization.org. There are videos there. The one I was trying to show was just made. It will eventually be posted within the next couple months, I would say. But there are some very beautiful ones already online.
Yeah, Giant Magellan Telescope. Just Google that. You'll get plenty of fun things. Where are we next? Yes.
Hi, it always amazed me the mathematics involved and how you can deduce so much on that. So rhetorically, we're not traveling away from other stars at the speed of light. So how can we see the background radiation from the Big Bang since electromagnetic waves travel at the speed of light? That would have passed through wherever our locus is in the universe a long, long time ago, but yet we see this background radiation yet today. How's that math?
Right. So this is a good question. So one of the many things, if this were a 20-part series of interviews, which maybe we can negotiate that with the library, but we didn't talk about the Big Bang very much, but we, you know, once Hubble discovered the universe is expanding, there's an implication that you play the movie backwards, and there's a moment when everything is on top of everything else, and that's the Big Bang. And it turns out that that's what general relativity, Einstein's theory, more or less suggests. There was a debate in the 50s as to whether or not we should mess around a little bit to try to avoid that dramatic conclusion, but in the 1960s, we found the leftover radiation from the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background radiation, Penzias and Wilson won the Nobel Prize for doing that. So if everything is on top of everything else, it's hot and it's glowing and it gives off light. Now we have this way of thinking that, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff like a ball or a point that explodes. But that's not what the Big Bang model is. The Big Bang model is all of space was crunched down and all of space comes into existence and all of space is full of this hot, dense, glowing stuff. So what the question is, you know, light from this early universe travels through space, and it, you know, it passes by where the Earth is, but if it wasn't that far away, then it has long since passed us by. So how do we see it? Well, the answer is there's light that started from further away that is passing by us now, and there's light that is even further away that will only pass by us in the future. So when you look out into the sky, you're looking into the past, because light travels at a speed, 1 light year per year. That's the way I remember it, theorist. And so if the universe is a finite number of years old, 13.8 billion years old, there's only a finite distance that you can see back. So you're seeing things earlier and earlier and earlier. And once you see the moment, once you're seeing so far away that it's soon after the Big Bang, you will see the Big Bang, like it or not. I mean, you'd like it because it's awesome because you see the Big Bang.
The Magellan Telescope, is that only going to be visible light, or is it going to be infrared or some electronic sensor or what?
It will be visible light and near infrared light, so out to about 10 microns. But most of the time, the observations will be optical out to two or so microns.
The air gets in the way if you try to look at things that are too far in the infrared or ultraviolet, if you're down here on Earth. Yeah.
Speaking of wavelengths of light, I've always been curious that dark energy and dark matter is a description of what we see as the effect. We don't know what the cause is. So is it accurate to say that we don't have the instruments that can actually detect what dark matter or dark energy is? In other words, from the radio spectrum up to infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray, and cosmic ray.
Yeah, so dark matter, there have been searches now for literally decades looking for these particles. And the issue is they really are very weakly interacting. And so one of the ways that people have spent a lot of effort doing is to look at the effects of these particles as they come in and they interact with the nuclei of atoms and look essentially for sound signals. And And so the difficulty, as I mentioned earlier, is that there are other things that could create a spurious signal. So people had to go very deep underground to lead shields and get rid of as many particles as they can, and they keep pressing down, you know, the limits on what these particles could be. But so far, there have been no detections. Another way to look, there's a satellite now called Fermi that is sensitive to gamma rays. And there's a signal from dark matter particles that might annihilate, interact with each other, and that you would get a gamma ray produced. And so there are intensive efforts now to search in that way. And the Large Hadron Collider, as you're colliding protons very, very rapidly that are accelerated to speeds approaching that of light, come together, particles are formed, and you might hope to discover a dark matter particle. But to date, they're just... no luck.
Do you think it would be fair to describe it as undetectable matter?
At the moment.
Undetectable?
Undetected.
Undetected, yes. Doesn't mean it's undetectable. It could be undetectable. We have no way of knowing that. I mean, that would be unfortunate. The universe turned out to be made in such a way that this thing is so elusive that we might not, you know.
But it could also be the next couple of years, front page news, we found the dark matter.
Yeah, I think the possibility that it will be discovered in the next 10 years is...
pretty good.
It's enough to keep people pretty excited and spending their careers doing it.
Great.
I wanted to go back to the telescopes. I was hearing that there's, along with the Magellan one that you were speaking of that you're dealing with, there were other two, I think one in Hawaii and another one in Chile, one that's supposed to have even larger... mirrors and the one you described, and I think another one with a couple hundred or so of the smaller 5-foot mirrors. Do each of these telescopes have, you know, a certain main purpose, if you will, that might be different than the Magellan? What would that be?
So you're correct. There are two other groups around the world that are building large telescopes, this class of extremely large new telescopes. One of them is a European effort. And the other two I should mention, so this is the only telescope that has a design that has these large 8.4-meter mirrors, and we have 7 of them. The others are made of 1-meter mirrors, and one will be a 30-meter telescope, and the other will be a 39-meter telescope. And as you say, one's in Hawaii, one's also in Chile. The scientific goals are really very similar. It's not a surprise that the kinds of things that people are excited about, we're all going to go after, we're all going to chase. Giant Magellan Telescope is very likely to be first, and if I have anything to do with it, it will be first.
Stop talking at libraries. Maybe you.
That's right. Spent my day doing that, and so Sean, I promised I would get him something before the talk. It didn't happen because I was working on the telescope. But in any case, and the other telescope is primarily Asian countries. They've all turned international, and it's interesting because in the days of Palomar, it could be one group. And one private group, not government-funded, that would build the world's largest telescope. And in the 1980s, there was a generation of telescopes that were built, and single institutions or small consortia of institutions, the U.S. government could build telescopes of those kinds of scales. But these ones are so large that a single country can't do it, a single institution can't do it. The U.S. government's not interested Well, they don't have the funding right now. It's just not something that is high priority. And so we've had to find other ways of doing that. And so these are being funded by private institutions with international government support, which is just, it's interesting. It's a different way, different model for doing science than we've ever had before.
Okay, two more questions.
All right, they better be good.
John's going to grade you.
I didn't ask that, that's right.
You put me under a lot of pressure there, and I want to apologize if you've already answered this question. But since I have the mic, if dark matter is undetected, how did you determine that it consisted of 25% and dark energy? I think you said 75% or something like that. So how did you measure it if it's undetected?
So this comes back to the issue that gravity, of course, is a long-range force, and these particles, if they exist, are interacting via gravity. So if they're there, they will have an effect on the luminous matter, the stuff that we can see, via gravity. So if we look in these clusters of galaxies, where there may be, say, 1,000 galaxies, they're held together by gravity, and they're moving at certain speeds. If there is not very much matter in that cluster, say, and the galaxies are moving very rapidly, they won't be bound. They can't be held on by the cluster. They'll just move out, you know, at that speed, and they'll go far away. So something has to be holding them there. So we can add up the mass that we see, the stuff that's in the luminous galaxies, and see how fast the galaxies are moving, and calculate how much stuff must be there that we don't see. And we can do that for clusters, we can do it for galaxies and individual stars, or the motions of stars and galaxies, and we can look for, again, hot gas, which would evaporate away unless there's something holding it there. And we know how much has to hold it there based on how much gas we see. So it's a series of very independent observations. They have nothing to do with one another. It's different physics that describes the gas and the stars, but they all are pointing to the same conclusion. And that's about 25% of the mass and overall mass plus energy in the universe is in a dark form that doesn't emit light.
I think it's also important to emphasize, because sometimes I get, you know, this criticism with a slightly moral tone, like they think that somehow we cosmologists are pulling something over on them with this dark matter and dark energy. So I'm here to tell you, we don't own stock in dark matter or dark energy. We don't want it to be there. We resisted. Zwicky came along and said, look, you need more stuff. No one paid any attention. Vera Rubin came along and said, no, really, guys, you need more stuff. And people were beginning to pay attention. And it still takes decades. The reason why we believe in this is because the data are forcing us to believe in it. And theorists such as myself would love to come up with a better explanation. I myself have proposed other hypothetical explanations to get rid of the dark matter or dark energy. They're not as good.
So he didn't mention, he said theorists have pencils and paper, but their most important tool is the wastebasket.
That's true. That's right.
Discarded ideas that don't fit with nature. They might be elegant and beautiful, but they have nothing to do with nature.
And we don't, our goal is not to prop up the ideas our successors had. Our goal, you know, we, the theoretical physicist advances on the desiccated corpses of their predecessors, right? We want to prove them wrong. If I could come up with an idea that was better than the dark matter idea, I'd be totally doing that.
But that's the thing, I think, often misunderstood in science in general, that it's a, that we just come up with these ideas, but crazy
Dude,
ideas.
What if there's like all this dark stuff in the universe?
Well, and I do. I have filing cabinets full of letters that people have sent me about their theories about the universe. I don't think you sent me one, but
I have a garbage.
But it, the, you know, the
all of theory.
The ultimate arbiter are data. If it doesn't work, it doesn't fit. And if the data are forcing you to a conclusion, and that's what the universe is telling us it is, even though we don't like it, and it's not very appealing, it isn't.
Preposterous.
It is preposterous. But now the evidence has become overwhelming. We can't escape it. It's not that we wanted it.
All right, one last question is right up here.
So I understand one aspect of the Magellan Telescope. And one of the problems, of course, is that you're on the Earth and you have the atmosphere to go through. But you have adaptive optics, which is a new technology. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so this is a technique called adaptive optics, and it makes use of the fact that you can actually change the position of your mirrors. And these mirrors can be changed to correct for the effects of the Earth's atmosphere. And so it turns out that above the Earth's atmosphere, there's a layer of sodium. And we can actually create, with lasers, artificial stars to act as beacons to compare, as a reference, what would the image of a star look like or a galaxy if it wasn't coming through the Earth's atmosphere. So we shine up the laser, it bounces back down, and light travels so fast, it can be done on, these corrections can be made in thousands of a second time scales. And we can actually deform the shape of the mirrors to correct and compensate for the effects of the Earth's atmosphere. So we don't have to go into space to be above the atmosphere. That was what Hubble afforded us for the first time. We could get away from the atmosphere. But we can now have a telescope that's 10 times the diameter of Hubble, and we can use this adaptive optic technique to make corrections for the distortions caused by the Earth's atmosphere. So it's a very powerful technique. It's already being used with telescopes on Earth, so it's not new technology that we now have to develop, but we'll take advantage of it for the Giant Magellan and these other telescopes.
Hubble would be very impressed.
He would be pleased.
And with that, I think I'm going to send great thanks to all of you, and especially to Wendy for coming here.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.